And we're with Robert Hastings as we talk about UFOs and nukes, and we'll be right back with him for more and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Robert Hastings with us. Robert, we were talking about the earliest point you think that some of these missile sites have been visited. Let's go back to that again.
Well, again, missiles weren't actually involved because they didn't come into play until the early 1960s. However, in 2009, a former Navy fighter pilot named Bud Clem contacted me and told me that his squadron was based near the Hanford site in Washington State and charged with guarding it, protecting it. This was in January of 1945. The war didn't end until August of 45. The Hanford site created plutonium for not only the nuclear bomb that was detonated in New Mexico, the Trinity site blast, but also the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki in Japan. And according to Clem, on three different occasions in January of 45, a large glowing orange object hovered directly over the Hanford site. And what they had then was prop-driven, not even jet, Hellcat fighters. And they went up to chase the thing on three occasions. And he told me that on all three occasions, as soon as they approached this object, it just took off so fast that it was out of sight in a matter of seconds. Now, documents by a researcher named Jan Aldrich, he's found U.S. Army documents from the 4th Army, I believe it is, based in Washington, who have confirmed now in 2013 what Bud Clem told me in 2009, that in fact, on three occasions in January of 45, radar picked up unknown targets hovering over and maneuvering around the Hanford site, and thereby independently confirming what he told me. Now, this particular story wasn't in my book because it came out a year after the book was published in 08. I should mention, I failed to do this earlier, that my book is only available at my website, which is ufohastings.com. Okay. Go to the book page. If you want to pay $100 from scalpers at Amazon, go to Amazon. But the book is much more
easy. It's up that high by them? Website. Unbelievable, isn't it? Scalpers.
And the film also on the documentary film page at my website, you can access the documentary film. But in any case, we had documents going back to the 1970s. That Bruce McAbee got into the public domain in the late 70s, confirming that other nuclear sites, the Los Alamos nuclear labs, Sandia labs in New Mexico, all nuclear weapons sites, various other sites, were in FBI documents that he pried loose in the Freedom of Information Act. People have asked all this time, you know, why, if the bombs were detonated in 1945, did we not start seeing UFO activity until 2 years later in 47? Well, we now know from Bud Clem and these documents that Jan Aldrich has produced that, in fact, from, you know, even before the bombs were dropped in Japan, you had UFO activity around a primary nuclear weapons site.
Why do you think they didn't stop the bombing of Japan?
I am asked that so often. I have no idea. You know, what I tell people is you're trying to basically interpret the mind of an alien. I think these are aliens that are doing this. And you have to try to put yourself in their shoes, so to speak, and figure out why they did this and didn't do that, on the other hand. And if you try to second guess them or try to, you know, go, well, this doesn't make sense to me because this, that, or the other, then I think you're really defeating the purpose of analyzing the situation. You need to look at the available data, see what patterns there are, see if it makes sense from our point of view, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. But the question is, if they're interfering with nuclear weapons functionality in the 60s, why didn't they do that in the 1940s and prevent the Japanese bombings? We simply don't know.
Did a UFO appear over Chernobyl in that accident?
That is very intriguing. I mentioned it in my book. In April of 1986, there was the Chernobyl commercial nuclear power plant disaster in Soviet Ukraine. The amount of radiation that was released was just horrendous. It drifted not only over the Soviet Union, but parts of Northern Europe. And again, this was 1986. And I believe it was 1991. in both Pravda, which is the leading Soviet newspaper, as well as in the Ukrainian press, there were independently published stories which said that persons who were involved with the Soviet radiation monitoring team who arrived at the site after the accident and were monitoring the ambient radiation in the air, these people have gone on the record, as reported both in the Russian and Ukrainian press, went on the record as saying that after some period of time when they were there monitoring the radiation and assessing the situation, what they described as a brass-colored sphere suddenly appeared in the air over the stricken reactor and hovered there for some 3 to 5 minutes. At one point, according to these published articles, two crimson-colored beams emanated from this brass-colored sphere directly down into the burning, smoldering pile, the nuclear pile that was exposed to the atmosphere. And then after some period, the number of seconds, the beams disappeared, the object raced off in the sky. And the story is that when they next measured the ambient radiation immediately after this object left, it had been reduced by two-thirds. Just a dramatic decrease in the amount of radiation in the air. Now, I've asked physicists, I'm not an expert in this field, but I've asked physicists about radioactive decay, and they say there is no known process in terms of our knowledge of physics that would allow for a dramatic, almost instantaneous reduction in the degree of radiation being created by radioactive decay. And so, presumably, you know, if this took place, and there were names of the witnesses in the article who reportedly saw this, they were a part of these Soviet radiation monitoring teams, and they are on the record as saying this took place. So, again, I haven't been able to personally interview people because of the distance involved, different country, different languages. But everything I've just described as a matter of record, you can find references to all of this online.
All right, let's take some calls here for you, Robert, as they begin to line up, and we'll continue chatting incredible information. Let's go to Wisconsin first. Frank is with us on the wildcard line. Frank, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Happy birthday, sir.
Well, thank you.
And hello, Mr. Hastings.
Hello.
I understand that the president is followed around by somebody with the football. And inside the football, which is a briefcase, I guess, are the launch codes. Were the various presidents involved in these almost launches?
I'm unaware of, you know, people that I interviewed are the field officers. They're the ones in the capsules. It's the information flow is basically one way. They give the information about the incident to the person who's debriefing them, usually a counterintelligence officer, OSI agent. Beyond that, they never hear anything about it. They don't know how far up this is kicked. Presumably, persons at a high level in the Pentagon are aware of these things going on. Whether or not the President of the United States, in all the decades that this has happened, whether the current president on any given incident is notified or not is open to question. I think and I've talked to people who have an intelligence background, the sense of it they have is that after the election of any given president, between the election and the inauguration, there are meetings with the incoming president at Camp David in Maryland with his advisors. And I'm of the opinion, and these persons who've talked to me believe that during those briefings, the incoming president, the president-elect, is given a general sense of the UFO reality and the fact that there are national security implications. But these people are of the opinion that politicians are not very favorably viewed by career intelligence people. You know, they know that this person is only going to be in there for 4 or 8 years. That person may or may not be able to keep a secret. You know, some people have drinking problems. They may talk while they're tipsy. Mm-hmm. And so the persons that have advised me who've indicated their sense of the situation is that the incoming president in any given administration is given just enough facts to know that this is real and this is national security. And if a situation develops, then they will be given more information, but they're not given a smorgasbord of facts about the UFO reality when they're first elected.
Robert, I'm glad you're doing this. Some people may say, why do I need to know about this? What do you tell them?
I just say, you know, this is take it or leave it. I mean, I understand that most people have their everyday lives. You know, this does not apparently at first glance directly impact them on a day-to-day basis. But again, we still have over 1,000 nuclear missiles deployed, as do the Russians. And being humans and given our track record of making mistakes, we, as long as the weapons exist, there is a potential risk for all of us. You know, we still have the potential to destroy human civilization, hundreds of millions of lives, as long as these weapons are in place. And it's clear from the testimony and the documents, the veterans who've talked to me, that someone has taken an interest in this situation. Somebody has interjected themselves into the situation, both here and in Russia, for 50 years or more, 60, 70 years even. And so clearly this is important. Some people have told me, some of the veterans, I mentioned this earlier, they've said, I know what you're talking about, but I'm not going to talk about it. And I don't think you ought to be talking about it publicly, Mr. Hastings. Well, with all due respect to that mindset, you know, if this is real, if this is ongoing, and given that it does involve such high stakes for all of us, then in my opinion, the American public and every human on earth needs to know that this is real and ongoing.
Jose in Alabama, east of the Rockies. Jose, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Mr. Norris and Mr. Hastings, what a heck of a show. I am a retired U.S. Army CID special agent who happened to be an 11-year-old Cuban refugee kid in Hialeah back in I came in August of 62, and this happened in 62 or 63, I'm really not sure. But I want you to know, and the public, the listening public, that I looked up at the sky when there was this dot of a flying aircraft of some sort flying at an incredible speed, and I would say maybe thousands of miles per hour or more, and it would come to a complete stop. Then it would generate circular colored waves around it, multiple colors, and then it would buzz off in a completely different direction and do the same thing. And I'm talking traveling a large distance at an extremely fast rate of speed, and then coming to a complete halt and generating the circular color beams that just radiated from it. And I've never seen it again, and I've never heard about it, but I'm calling to see if by any chance you've heard of anything like this. I mean, it did like maybe four or five zigzag stops, and then it just flew away and vanished.
We get a lot of reports on things like that, Robert, don't you?
You know, what he's describing is certainly not a commonly described description of UFO, the appearance of UFOs in the sky, but certainly there are atmospheric effects, there are color effects from time to time that are reported. So I'm not surprised to hear what he's described. He mentioned 1962. Let me quickly say something about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mentioned earlier, that's the one incident the public knew where we almost had World War III. That was in October of 62. In 2005, I was contacted by a man named Chris Smith. He was a jet engine mechanic in the Air Force at Loring Air Force Base, a nuclear bomber base for many, many years. And he did provide his service records. I know he was in that position at that base at that time. And what he described during the Cuban Missile Crisis, apparently there was an alert. And again, he's a jet engine mechanic. All they knew is that there was a mid-air emergency involving two B-52s that were flying over the Atlantic Ocean, basically in circles. And if President Kennedy had said, you know, it's war, it's, you know, we're going to bomb the Soviets, these bombers would have headed over the North Pole to the Soviet Union. And so suddenly these two bombers that were out over the Atlantic had some sort of crisis unspecified. Chris Smith and all of the other aircraft maintenance people rushed to the flight line just in time to see the bombers landing. And Chris Smith said that after the first bomber landed and the second one was coming in for a landing, someone screamed, "Look, what's that? What's that?" And everyone looked up, and he said there was this monstrous size cigar-shaped object above the flight line, and it was there for, he estimated, 1 or 2 minutes, and then it took off. And again, this was at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. This incident, I tried to get the confirmation of his jet engine mechanic partner. I'm not going to identify him. He didn't want to talk. He didn't deny anything Chris Smith said, but he did not want to go on the record. So I'm at this point making an appeal to any of your listeners. If you were in the Air Force during the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62, whether at Loring or any other base, if you are aware of UFO activity during the Cuban Missile Crisis, please get in touch with me at ufohastings.com. None of the testimony I get from veterans is ever reported publicly unless I have that veteran's permission.
Are there ever any reports, Robert, of occupants in any of these craft by these sites?
Not in any case that I'm aware of involving the nuclear weapons cases. And it's very frustrating to me. I keep hoping I come across someone who not only saw the craft, but did see some sort of entity. But after this many years of interviewing, seeking out and interviewing veterans, not one of them had that kind of story to tell. Now, interestingly, this is a variation of what you've asked. Robert Salas mm-hmm. was one of the first nuclear missile officers to break this story about UFO shutting down nukes. He was the co-sponsor of my press conference in Washington, D.C. in 2010. Robert Salas is a patriot in my mind. He's a courageous man. He was one of the first people to go public with this kind of information. I'm going to say 2 years ago now, confessed that in, I believe, 1985, nearly 20 years after his experience in the Air Force, he claims that he had a bedroom encounter with a small entity. And, Bob has everything, to lose by going public with this. He's already being beaten up by the skeptics who say, no, he made it all up. UFOs never shut down his missiles. And now he's publicly saying that some 20 years later, he had a bedroom encounter with an entity, which, of course, many people report all over the planet. Now, I have subsequently, in the last decade, I believe I'm up to 7 individuals, including Bob, veterans who had missile site experiences or other incidents in the Air Force involving nuclear weapons. They have come back to me after the fact, independently. None of these people know each other. And they've independently told me that they had what we would call abduction experiences in the years following their Air Force experience. And again, as I was saying earlier, trying to make sense of all of this, how all the pieces of the puzzle fit together is really a challenging task. All I would say is these persons are credible. I have their service records. They were reluctant to tell me about these subsequent experiences when they first allowed me to interview them, but then because of their conscience, they felt they had to come forward and talk about it. So we have a subset of these military witnesses who were involved in the nuclear weapons cases who later had some sort of what we would call an abduction experience.
Great. We're going to come back and take some final calls with Robert Hastings in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Robert Hastings with us, our final segment here. Robert, in the documentary, UFOs and Nukes, The Secret Link Revealed, what would you say would be one of the most startling aspects of that documentary?
I think without question, the most dramatic incident that I've heard about from a military veteran, actually two veterans, is what's called the Big Sur incident. A man named Dr. Bob Jacobs, he's a retired college professor, and another academic named Dr. Florenz Mansman were at Vandenberg Air Force Base in 1964. Dr. Jacobs was in charge of a photographic team that photographed nuclear missile launches through a high-powered telescope. in some date that we're trying to pin down, probably the 15th of September, 1964. They were filming this launch. Everything seemed to go normally. And the day later, Bob Jacobs was called into Major Mansman's office and said, watch this. And, you know, all of this activity is taking hundreds of miles downrange. The people at the telescopic site can't see it with the naked eye. So Bob didn't know why he was being called in to watch the film of the launch, but he said that on the screen, he saw the dummy nuclear warhead separate from the missile, and suddenly a disc-shaped object with a dome flew into camera frame, circled the dummy warhead, and at four different junctures fired beams of light at it, what appeared to be, he said, similar to lightning in appearance, but not quite. And then the missile, the UFO rather, disappeared out of camera frame, and the dummy nuclear warhead went tumbling into the ocean hundreds of miles short of target. Now, when Bob was called in to watch this film of this traumatic incident, you know, he had no idea this had taken place until he saw it on the screen. He said there were two men in gray suits sitting in the audience in this small group of people watching the film. Many years later, when he contacted Dr. Mansman about this, he learned these guys were CIA officers who had confiscated the film. Bob was simply told by Mansman, you know, this never happened, don't talk about it. But his recollection, he was never told it was top secret. Apparently, though, the CIA made this top secret, the implication being that UFOs can not only shut down nuclear missiles in the ground in their silos, but they can actually knock them out of the air once they're flying across the globe in the air in near space. So that's almost certainly the most dramatic incident in the film. It occurs to me when I mentioned the film earlier, which again is available at Vimeo on demand, we have a promotional code for your listeners. If they go to vimeo.com /on-demand/ UFOs and nukes, hopefully this will be put up at your website. Mm-hmm. If they put in the promo code C2C2, again, C2C2, they can buy the film half price. And it's basically, if you don't use the code, it's $9.99 for unlimited downloads. It's 50% of that price if you put in this promotional code C2C2.
All right, now back to the phones. Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Howdy, John. Glad to be back with you. Good. I wonder if you could, the two of you could rule out something for me. Could this be back-engineered extraterrestrial aircraft with hack from the sites of the nuclear missile sites, and when one does something, the other finds out about it and does it too? It's far-fetched, I know, but I want you to rule that out for me. And do you think we have any one-upsmanship on extraterrestrials? Their technology supposedly is thousands of years ahead of ours. Do you think we have any one-upsmanship on them on weapons?
This is Robert responding. If I understand you correctly, what I think is actually going on is you have an outside third party. The technology is not human. The radar data alone suggests these objects fly orders of magnitude faster than ours. They can do instantaneous stop and hover in midair, which no aircraft on Earth can do after traveling 2,000, 3,000 miles an hour. And the missile launch officers, all the missile maintenance personnel that I've interviewed say that when skeptics say this was some sort of exercise, a military exercise, test readiness of our nuclear forces, they all laugh because they said our missiles were shut down for nearly 24 hours. No government exercise is going to allow, you know, some percentage of our strategic nuclear forces to be shut down and inoperative, you know, just so much scrap metal sitting in the ground. So the hypothesis proposed by skeptics that, you know, these are simply exercises, just, you know, the people who were there laugh because they know that our nuclear forces were impacted dramatically. Some number of targets wouldn't have been hit in the Soviet Union if war had been declared. And again, you know, the Air Force exercise theory, that obviously would not apply in the Soviet Union. We have no control over their missiles. And would we really activate missiles that are aimed at the Soviets? Would the Soviets actually activate missiles at us, knowing that we would retaliate just for the purpose of an exercise? No, of course not. So you have this outside party. There's nothing reverse engineered about it. We have no control, apparently, over what they can do to the missiles, and they're doing it on a regular basis.
Indeed, indeed. Frank, thanks for the call. Let's go to Jim in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, Bob.
Hello.
An observation and a comment. When they do these reenactments of missile sightings over the aircraft over the missile sites, if they would call the guards security policemen rather than just guards. I know there's civilian guards out there, but security policemen might wake up a lot of the hundreds and hundreds of security policemen that have witnessed these aircraft. And then one comment is, wasn't there one incident where one security policeman unloaded his M16 rifle on one of these over the top of the missile sites? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Last part of your question first. Actually, there was a hoax perpetrated back in the early 80s by a man named Richard Doty. He is a retired OSI agent. Mm-hmm. He's admitted to forging documents and engaging in other kinds of disinformation that was directed at Linda Moulton Howe and other researchers, Paul Benowitz, back in the early 80s. And Doty has been implicated in the forgery of a document in which it was alleged that a security guard at a missile site at Ellsworth Air Force Base fired on an alien. That has been thoroughly discredited. There have been a couple of other hoaxes perpetrated in recent years. All the facts in these supposedly real accounts, the locations of the nuclear missile sites, the squadrons are in, and all this, all the information is garbled. It's somebody just having a joke or purposely trying to muddy the waters, like Richard Doty was admittedly doing back in the early 80s. So I'm unaware of any credible case where a being was seen, an entity was seen at one of these missile sites, just the craft. And I'm unaware of any legitimate case where an alien, quote unquote, had been fired upon by one of our security police.
All right, great. Thank you. Next up, let's go to Chris in Wichita, Kansas, first-time caller. Hi, Chris. Thanks for holding.
Hey, Chris. Hey, George. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
Hey, Robert.
Hello.
So just recently, a couple hours ago, I just had a UFO experience. Me and some buddies of mine were having a bonfire, and we saw two very bright lights out on the horizon, hovering, and 20 minutes later, they were kind of like floating around each other, and they came towards us, and I believe them to be two like stealth bombers because the way they were shaped, they had like the one engine in the back, and anyways, as the second one flew over, I saw like a orange anomaly on the top of it, and then trailed behind it. I'm unsure what this is, but I believe it has some UFO experience.
Well, they're probably everywhere, no doubt about that. Thank God they're not by silos.
Sighting, it's amazing how many sightings have taken place worldwide, and the media still doesn't get it. It's still a joke for most journalists. Scientists, consider this an indignity. They won't lower their noses long enough to look at the data. The number of scientists that, have actually seriously looked at the information relating to UFOs, you could count on one hand. Dr. James McDonald, back in the 60s, early 70s.
A great researcher, by the way.
One of the few scientists to investigate this. He came to the conclusion and told a congressional committee in 1968 that he thought, based on 2 years of scientific study, that these were extraterrestrial craft. Now, unlike the vast majority of scientists who've never studied the subject, he had an informed opinion based on following the scientific method of analyzing data. So it's frustrating as hell when these things are going on all the time, and you can't get anyone in a position of authority, so to speak, the scientific community or the media, to take this seriously.
Have any careers been ruined because of these sightings?
Again, all the people that I've talked to, I'm gonna name two exceptions in a moment, but All of the people over the years who've talked to me have never been harassed. The FBI has not knocked on their door. They haven't had their retirement paid docked. The threat of all of that is the government's card. That's what they're playing, just the fear that they can instill by threatening to harass these people who come forward, but they never do. I think they realize that, you know, if these veterans are courageous enough to talk to me and to go on camera on CNN, that if they leaned on them and harassed them, that would just backfire on them. These guys would go to the media and really scream. Now, unfortunately, there were two exceptions. I mentioned this incident in October of 2010 at F.E. Warren Air Force Base, where there was the sighting of this huge cigar-shaped object. My intermediary was a retired missile targeting tech. I specifically asked him not to approach active duty people, just to see if there were rumors floating about this incident maybe being involved with a UFO, the communications disruption. Whether he misunderstood what I was asking him or took it of it as on his own volition, he did contact two active duty missile maintenance techs who did talk about these sightings occurring during this disruption period. What we subsequently learned was when these two guys retired a year later in June, coincidentally, they both retired in June of 2011, they were told in their exit interview, when they retired, that a flag was being put in their service record, which basically said that they had leaked classified information. So we basically figured out that these two active duty techs, either my communications with the retired tech had been compromised, or his communications with these two guys had been compromised. Somebody had apparently learned that they were talking to this guy and myself. What this basically meant was both these guys were looking for jobs in the aerospace industry upon retiring from the military. This flag, this warning in their jacket, their retirement folder, would have probably jeopardized those careers, post-military careers. About a year later, we learned that both of them were successfully employed in the aerospace industry. And so, this initial period of anxiety that we had did work out for the best. So I don't approach active duty military personnel intentionally because I don't want to ruin anyone's career. But the retired guys who've talked to me, not one of them has been harassed over the years.
We have Michael in Texas. Michael, let's squeeze you in here. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, sir?
Good, Michael. Thank you.
All right. Now I was calling worked for the Air Force and then got out of the Air Force, worked on the other side of it, always at these big nuke bases. And I've always had one thing in common, George. These UFOs, beings, whatever they are, they're here and they're trying to take whatever nukes or missiles we have in those silos. And I am so serious about this. We need to step our game up and put a defense up, because if they get these, I'm telling you, George, they could blow a black hole in the atmosphere and suck this earth up. And the stuff that I've worked on, even if I tried to explain it, people would not be able to understand what I'm talking about.
All right, in the time we've got left, Robert Hastings, do you sense any of that they want to confiscate these nukes?
No, I don't. And, I think their technology is so ahead of us, they don't need to mess with nuclear weapons. Some people think that they're sucking energy from our warheads. I don't think that's the case. I think their technology is so beyond what we have. Their actions shooting down the warhead in flight, as the Big Sur incident involved, the fact that they've tampered with missiles and shut them down, I think is indicative of their concern about humans' folly. You know, we have these weapons. We can destroy our civilization, pollute our planet, and possibly impact their own presence and projects here. But I don't think there's anything in the type of threat that this gentleman is suggesting, with all due respect.
Robert Hastings, very quickly, give out that website again.
My website is ufohastings.com. If you go to the book page, you can get the book for $24.95. And if you go to the documentary film page, it'll take you to the Vimeo on-demand site. Again, if you put in the C2C2 promo code, you can get the purchase of the film, unlimited downloads for 50% off.
Great. Thanks, Robert. Always great talking to you. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasore, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.